it's not worth fighting for. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I need a I'll leave it with this one.
I need a night nurse real far.
Indian, go and pick up yourself, you see.
Your best just to make it quick. I need it. Woman tend to the sick. I need it. I need it. Because there must be something she can do. This heart is broken in two pieces, baby. In pieces. Tell her it's a case of emergency. Hey, Jade, I'm gonna get the heart surgery.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, February 7th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 124 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have a full show for you today, including a report from a protest outside of Secretary of State Antony Blinken's house. News about a major boycott victory in Japan against an Israeli weapons maker explicitly as a consequence of the International Court of Justice's ruling, a discussion on the possibilities of a ceasefire, and of course, analysis of the Palestinian resistance's defense of Gaza. But first, here is the news. Israel's military campaign in Gaza has resulted in at least 100,000 Palestinians killed, injured, or missing and presumed dead, around 4% of the population of 2.3 million, as it enters its fifth month, reports our colleague Maureen Claire Murphy. The following is from her latest report. 60% of the more than 27,000 Palestinian fatalities recorded by the health ministry in Gaza since October 7th were women and children. At least 17,000 children in Gaza are unaccompanied or separated from their family, according to UNICEF. Khan Yunis in southern Gaza was bearing the brunt of the bombardment while Palestinian resistance groups fought Israeli ground forces across much of Gaza in recent days, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has reported. Israeli forces bombed residential blocks and high-rises in multiple areas of Khan Yunis on Monday, causing significant destruction. Heavy fighting continues near Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis, quote, jeopardizing the safety of medical staff, the wounded, and the sick, as well as thousands of internally displaced persons, according to the UN. While details of a possible ceasefire are being discussed in Doha, Maureen writes that, quote, Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister, told troops that, quote, we are completing the mission in Khan Yunis and we will reach Rafah as well and eliminate every terrorist there who threatens to harm us. Three prominent Palestinian human rights groups warned Monday that an expansion of Israel's ground operations in Rafah, in the southernmost area of Gaza, appears to be imminent. Such an escalation, quote, would significantly exacerbate the ongoing genocidal acts perpetrated by the Israeli military and authorities against the Palestinian population in Gaza, the rights groups warned. Maureen Claire Murphy writes that, quote, some 1.3 million Palestinians, more than half of Gaza's population, are currently concentrated in Rafah after being displaced from other areas of the territory. Given the current population density of the area, an attack on Rafah could, quote, result in an unprecedented loss of Palestinian lives, according to the rights groups. It may also force hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza to flee to Egypt, quote, which would constitute the crime of forcible deportation, the groups added. The potential scenario could surpass the number of Palestinians forcibly expelled by Zionist militias and the Israeli military during the 1948 Nakba, they said. To that end, the majority of all buildings in Gaza have likely been damaged or destroyed, according to an analysis of satellite data, Maureen reports. The UN estimates that more than 650,000 displaced Palestinians in Gaza, quote, will have no home to return to, and that many more will be unable to return immediately due to the level of damage surrounding infrastructure, as well as the risk posed by explosive remnants of war. For much more reportage on the situation on the ground in Gaza, read Maureen Claire Murphy's latest report, Ceasefire Elusive as Gaza Genocide Enters Fifth Month, on electronicintifada.net. Meanwhile, UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, will be forced to shut down its operations as soon as the end of the month if funding is not restored, according to the agency's director, Philippe Lazzarini. Israel has not let up on the attacks against the agency and humanitarian aid deliveries. The UN agency said that a convoy carrying food aid was hit by Israeli naval gunfire while waiting to move into northern Gaza on Monday. 16 donor countries, including the U.S., the agency's largest funder, suspended $440 million worth of aid after Israel made unverified allegations that a handful of UNRWA's staff in Gaza were involved in the October 7th attacks. However, as Sharon Jang at Truthout reported on Tuesday, quote, a key Israeli intelligence dossier used by countries to justify defunding the primary aid group for Palestinian refugees contains no evidence to back up Israel's allegations against the group. Israeli officials, Jang writes, were reportedly shocked that the information had even gotten out to foreign officials. The New York Times reported that, quote, Israel has made so many accusations against UNRWA over the years that no one expected this claim to be the one that stuck, the Israeli foreign ministry officials said. Our colleague Michael F. Brown writes that, quote, Israel has long sought to disrupt and destroy UNRWA, the UN agency established in 1949, specifically to protect the Palestinian refugees expelled by Israel during the Nakba. UNRWA provides essential health and educational services to Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. Israel's long-held intention to destroy UNRWA was revitalized late last year when Israel's foreign ministry privately laid out plans to push the agency out of Gaza altogether, Michael F. Brown writes. Maureen Claire Murphy, in her report for the Electronic Intifada last week, writes that, quote, Palestinian human rights groups warned that the suspension of funds leading to the halt of humanitarian aid in Gaza could constitute complicity in genocide. This is particularly so in the case of the U.S. and Germany, two of UNRWA's primary donors. The Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention said that the decision to suspend funding, quote, represents a shift by several countries from potential complicity in genocide to direct involvement in engineered famine. The Institute added that, quote, it is an attack on what remains of personal security, liberty, health, and dignity in Palestine. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees is the largest provider of humanitarian aid in Gaza, where the vast majority of the population depend on it for their sheer survival, UNRWA said last week. Two-thirds of Gaza's population of 2.3 million are refugees registered with UNRWA. More than 150 UNRWA staff are among the some 27,000 people killed in Gaza since October 7th, and more than 140 of the agency's facilities have been damaged or destroyed, including its Gaza City headquarters. And that was from Maureen Claire Murphy's report, Funding Freeze Could Halt UNRWA Operations by End of Month. And for more, read Michael Brown's in-depth analysis, States Gutting UNRWA Are Complicit in Genocide, both on electronicintifada.net. And an update from a story we covered last week on the live stream. On last Wednesday's show, we were joined by our friend Leila El-Haddad, who talked about her role testifying as one of the plaintiffs in a federal case brought by Palestinian Americans against the Biden administration over complicity in Israel's genocide. The judge issued his ruling last week, and even though he dismissed the case on jurisdictional grounds, explaining that the court lacked power to resolve a matter of foreign policy, he did acknowledge the, quote, undisputed evidence that Israel's ongoing siege against Palestinians in Gaza is, quote, intended to eradicate a whole people and therefore plausibly falls within the international prohibition against genocide. U.S. District Judge Jeffrey White called it a rare instance where, quote, the preferred outcome is inaccessible to the court. quote, it is every individual's obligation to confront the current siege in Gaza, the judge wrote. And Catherine Gallagher, senior staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, said that, quote, while we strongly disagree with the court's ultimate jurisdictional ruling, we urge the Biden administration to heed the judge's call to examine and end its deadly course of action. Together with our plaintiffs, we will pursue all legal avenues to stop the genocide and save Palestinian lives, Gallagher said. For more, read my piece, U.S. Judge Rebukes Biden's Unflagging Support for War on Gaza. And finally, an excerpt from one of our feature stories written by our contributor Sundus Al-Fayoumi in Gaza. Quote, I am very worried about my sister Dua, she writes. She is a patient at Al-Amal Hospital, located in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The hospital has been under Israeli siege for more than 2 weeks. Dua has been paralyzed because of an Israeli attack on Al-Burej refugee camp, central Gaza, in October. She needs surgery outside Gaza, but the siege on the hospital means that she cannot leave. Read more from Sundus Al-Fayoumi's feature, My Sister is Under Siege in a Gaza Hospital, on electronicintifada.net. Those are just some of the many stories we've published on the Electronic Intifada over the last few days. Head over to electronicintifada.net for much more. Thank you again for joining us. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. And as Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, tours the region, his house near Washington, D.C. continues to be the site of 24-hour protests against his direct complicity in and support for Israel's genocide. Blinken and his family hear the protests day and night and see them whenever they leave home. We're joined now by Hazami Barmada, an activist and social entrepreneur who has been leading the protests. Hazami, it's so good to have you with us today.
Hi, thank you all for having me.
So tell us what you are up to right now, where you are, and what's been happening.
So we are here on the side of the road. What is behind me right here is the home of Secretary of State Antony Blinken on this very narrow road in McLean, Virginia. We have been camping out in makeshift tents on both sides of the roads from the evening of the ICJ, the International Court of Justice order, and also coincidentally the eve of the day, the federal court case against the Biden administration, specifically Blinken, Biden, and Austin. We are out here, and every time they leave or enter their home, as you might see behind me, we doused the street and the cars with this red symbolic blood of Gaza's children. And we have signage all over the place that reminds Blinken of his direct role in enabling, funding, normalizing, endorsing, and in essence, perpetuating an ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people.
And Hazami, you told us that we know that Antony Blinken today is in Israel to discuss the latest ceasefire proposal. And you told us a little while ago that his wife just left home a little while ago. Did she hear you?
Yes, absolutely. The wife of Blinken comes by us numerous times a day. We know they've changed the security apparatus of how she comes in and out of home due to her growing discomfort that we've not only heard about directly from both the police and the security staff themselves, but also in the way she drives. She bolts right by us, obviously cannot miss us. We are lined on both sides of the road and right by the gate. So we see her entering and exiting. We also see the children in the car, although they've put blankets and towels over the windows of the vehicles. And she not only sees us and hears us, but is also very clearly uncomfortable. And for those that don't know, Blinken's wife, Evan Ryan, actually works for the administration. She's the cabinet secretary. And Blinken himself has a company which she benefits financially from that actually supports national security, which, you know, the military industrial complex is connected to. And so, you know, we often say that, unfortunately, in Gaza, you know, there's constantly this idea of collective collateral damage. There is not, you know, you don't spare the rest of society just because you're supposedly going after Hamas. And I often say two cars that pass by here is, if this was an operation to eliminate Hamas, if Hamas was hiding in Tel Aviv, would you bomb it to the ground? And if your answer is no, then it's not about Hamas. It's about the fact that you perceive Palestinian lives to be dispensable, which is why we have no problem at all screaming at and targeting the family and the folks that work to enable Blinken living this life behind this wall. I must also say that the security fence has been added recently with mesh, so you can't see as easily through the gate, and then additional cameras have been added to the various entrances here as we've been out here.
So I think we actually have a video. It's not from today. It's from another day when you actually greeted Antony Blinken in person, at least when he was in his car. We can take a look at that. Now he can clearly see you. Oh, there you go. There goes the blood. You must have a significant budget for red paint.
We have a lot of amazing volunteers who actually make this paint for us. The paint recipe itself is one of the most asked about questions that I get on my social media. We mix it with tempera paint, which is all washable and food coloring and cornstarch, so it is not only edible but also safe to use, which is important just from a ability to continue to do this type of action. We've actually seen Blinken numerous times. The video you just showed is right before his last trip to Tel Aviv, so we've actually been here repeatedly since then, and just said goodbye to him on his way out the door this time around, also on his way also to the Middle East. He's been there numerous times since we've been here. But yes, we see his motorcade coming to and from work numerous times a day, sometimes every single day for the last couple of weeks.
And you are you planning to stay there for the long term?
You know, honestly, I didn't necessarily have a plan in mind when we did this. We've been doing direct actions as a group, a grassroots movement, now for, you know, over 110 days, all over what we call institutions of power. We physically put our bodies on the ground doing die-ins. We've done blood dumps in front of staff entrances of the White House and State Department, where staff literally have to physically walk over the blood that we dump as they approach.
We can actually look at that. Yeah, let's take a look.
So they have to walk through this on their way to work.
They do. They do. And it's extremely uncomfortable. And that's exactly the point. Our goal is to center the discomfort. Our goal is to highlight the hypocrisy. Our goal is to make sure that American officials and folks that work in this administration, and there they are trying to go around us, for example. And I tell them, you can try to go around us, but you can't avoid your conscience. And we intentionally go during business hours directly to the people that are directly responsible for these policies, for the mis and disinformation that is being peddled to justify the violence and the genocide against the Palestinian people. And it is very important for us to be there constantly and persistently for days and days on end. We are there almost daily at these different entrances. We alternate between the entrances. But, you know, again, the point of us is that politicians in the United States are able to sanitize their lives, sanitize their daily lives from the impacts and the reality of what they do in different parts of the world. It's why we call this Kibbutz Blinken, right? So we've heard repeatedly the administration has not been hard enough on settlements, illegal settlements in the West Bank, and on stolen land throughout Israel. And for us, you know, our kind of initial joke was, since Blinken is so okay with settlements, then he should be okay with this one. Because so often we find that American politicians and folks that are funding, fueling, and normalizing this are somehow okay with it until it's on their soil, until it's in their space, until it impacts them and their families. And that is the direct reason that we are right here, where we do get criticism, where people say, oh, Blinken's family are innocent to this, or something to the effect of, well, doesn't he deserve to rest? Why should Blinken be able to come home at 5 p.m. and rest in this ivory tower with all the security when the children in Gaza and the families in Gaza have no moment of rest with American-made bombs and American-made military apparatus being used against them 24/7 with no place to call home, with no security, with no safety? And so there's no such thing as being off hours when the genocide is ongoing and you are directly complicit in peddling lies over and over and over again, including, for example, the lie he peddled about UNRWA and, you know, seeing very credible evidence literally happened while we were right here in these tents that were flooded. And in real time, we saw Gaza, tents in Gaza that were flooded. Obviously, it's no comparison because people in Gaza have no food. It's mass starvation, intentional starvation. People have no access to warm blankets or clothes or anything where we are able to, you know, to change and to get people to come bring us towels. But we invited Blinken on that day to come out and join us in these tents, to experience just a tiny, 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 tiny fraction, which isn't even comparable, of what it's like to be in cold, in rain, you know, outside on the streets with all this traffic around him. And of course, he denied and didn't even acknowledge our existence out here. But we know that they're impacted by it. We know because of the changing in all the security around here. And also, I see his face. I look directly in his face every single morning because I'm on that exact side of the street. And I look through the window, not even a foot and a half away from his face. And I see it. And he looks tired. He looks frustrated. He looks beat down. So does his wife, who has no tinting on her windows. We see her face very clearly. And to me, that is success.
Good. Hazami, can you talk a little bit about the legality of these protests? I know that a lot of Americans think that this is, you know, you'd be swept up by police immediately. This, you know, that police would be very keen on shutting this kind of protest down. But it is actually very, very legal and a part of our you know, very quickly waning civil rights. But can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, even I was very intimidated when we first started doing this type of work. We came out to Blinken's house in December, and I remember we used to park way down there and walk up this dark, windy street, you know, being really afraid. And now we've literally occupied not only both sides of the street, but all the parking all around this space is now occupied by our group. I think the reality of legality is a lot of protesters don't know our rights. It's really important to understand local rights and local laws, but then also how those intersect with, for example, protected federal activity of First Amendment rights. We, for example, know that being here in Arlington law, which is Blinken's house is actually on the property line between Arlington and Fairfax, right there, literally at that car, is the line between Fairfax and Arlington County. So his property is the furthest house on the property line between the different counties. In Arlington County, there are certain restrictions to sound ordinance, to what you can and cannot do on public spaces. We also pulled the plot of land, so I was able to see the actual plot of land and highlighted the fact that actually Blinken's fence actually sits feet past their property line, which is something that I'll be following up with the county on separately. It appears that their property line is actually further back and their gate actually transgresses over public property. So the area that we stand, where I took the video from that you showed of Blinken, actually is public property. Thus, they cannot ask us to leave from that location. We remind the police often. They often come trying to bully us. Secret Service tries to bully us. There's a lot of different types of security personnel around here, from Secret Service to State Department security personnel. We've seen all types of security when we do things at the Israeli ambassador's home. Folks from the State Department get deployed out to us also. But knowing your rights and then also knowing that a lot of police and security expect people not to know their rights. So we printed out the plot of land. I plant out the legal codes. I plant out all of the items that also show that federal law sometimes trumps local law in the case that religious and political activities are actually protected First Amendment. And so in those cases, the sound ordinance of Arlington County are no longer applicable to us. Now, we have been stopped from using musical instruments and big stereos. On the first 4 days we were here, we had a huge sound system, and I mean huge sound system. We had about 18 megaphones with sirens spinning around the clock, and we know it drove them absolutely crazy because the neighbors four houses down, who are actually all very supportive of us, came and told us that their entire house was shaking from the sound. Now, that we were told that we could no longer do because of a state law in Virginia that's unfortunately very vaguely written, and we are working with an expert team of lawyers now to try to understand, because it says you cannot disturb, and I quote, tranquility of house. What does tranquility of house mean? How is that defined? And again, we push back often and say, why is it that people here can live in tranquility of homes protected when, again, they commit atrocities? So we use our voices, which is why my voice is pretty,
mabhouh. I don't know how to even say that in English.
Of course, yeah.
Doesn't work well. We continue and we have a lot of people that come out through the day and through the night honking their horns, coming to scream with us. And so, you know, in unison, when you have 30, 40, 50 people yelling facing a house, it still delivers a very strong message without the sound equipment.
Well, it's really incredible. And I want to say from my personal perspective, and this is why we were so keen to have you on today and let people see what you're doing. I can think of almost nothing else that is more important than what you're doing right now. Everything, people. I mean, let me be clear. All of the demonstrations, the rallies, the activism, contacting representatives, it's all important. But there's something so visceral to this because I think it is so easy. It's even easy for us to shut out what's happening in Gaza. But it's even easier if you are protected and coddled by wealth and comfort and by the security apparatus of the United States government. So to pierce through that and tell Antony Blinken that there is a direct line between the things he says and does and the murdered babies in Gaza is so important. I think that is absolutely amazing. And not just with Blinken, but also with the White House staff. And as you also mentioned, the Israeli ambassador. Let's take a look at your action outside the Israeli ambassador's home in Washington.
This morning in front of the house of the ambassador of Israel to the United States. The home of the ambassador of Israel to the United States. The home of Israel ambassador. We are here to say you cannot have a peaceful morning. We will not allow you to have a peaceful morning when a genocide is ongoing. Rise and shine! Rise and shine! Rise and shine! Of the ambassador of Israel to the United States, and we are giving him a good morning welcome. We are at all entrances. We have our ready to go. The home of the Israeli ambassador, for those that are tuning in to the U.S., we have a shit ton of sound machines.
So you call, we just learned the term you use. It's called a blood dump. You've also done a blood dump at Raytheon. And we can take a quick look at that too. And then you can tell us about what's the message you're trying to send here as well. So that's Raytheon is the weapons maker, and so you're hitting the U.S. officials, the White House staff, the Israeli ambassador's home, and the weapons makers like Raytheon. I have a question. Do you take requests? Can I send you a list of? Because I'd like to see a blood dump at the German embassy. Can that be arranged? Am I allowed to take requests?
It's funny. We actually have done quite a bit of stuff that is not yet not public.
Okay, all right.
We've done them at all the weapons manufacturers, Elbit Systems, Boeing, Raytheon. Interestingly enough, also a lot of these weapons companies have no signage. We've done it at APAC. There's not a single sign in front of the American Public Affairs Council that has any signs. We there did what we call dirty money, where we threw fake money in the air and started spraying blood all over it, blood water. We also have done them in front of Facebook and Meta, their offices in downtown DC, in front of Google, in front of Microsoft, who are all complicit with providing technology to support the apartheid and illegal occupation in both the West Bank and the atrocities in Gaza through spying. And so we have done these and we continue to do them. We do take some requests. We are additionally starting to target more homes in residential neighborhoods. Obviously, there's a bit more trickiness to, you know, the fact that these are very thin roads. And I'm just going to let you see how close our tents are to the main road. This is the main roadway. And you can see huge trucks coming by. And these are our tents where we sleep. And so, you know, we obviously try to make sure that we keep our people safe at all times while doing these actions. And I'm just going to let you see this. But yes, we are hopefully going to continue to target additional people. Again, this is the signage. This is his entrance exit of his home. And this is directly what he sees. Bloody Blinken, Secretary of Genocide, all of our signage around, the genocide that's happening and making sure people know and we expose this. And the signs go on both sides of the road. I don't know if you can see those, but yes.
And that's amazing. The signs are incredible. And I'm seeing in the comments now on our live stream, some people in the DC area saying, I want to come down and join the protest. Can people do that?
We encourage people to come out specifically from 7 to 9 a.m. and 7 to 9 p.m., which is when they're home. We know from Blinken in a recent interview that he did that he says since he's home a lot, he's away a lot, that he tries to use breakfast time as sacred time. We want to make sure that his children hear us and ask the question, Daddy, why are they calling you Bloody Blinken? Because that's what I envision. They probably ask every time their car comes by us and I say, your father is a murderer of babies, baby murderer. And we know it's impacting them because they put up, they put up towels on the windows of the cars of the children, which just happened recently, actually. Couple days ago. But yes, people are more than welcome to come join us in the evenings and during the day. We do have pretty strict kind of rules around the use of things so we don't get shut down, but we encourage and welcome folks that are willing to come. And we push the boundary of legal protest and staying within the constitutional, yeah, our constitutional rights and what's legally available to us. And that's how we've been able to continue to do this.
And you also want people to stick to the basic message. What is that
Correct.
Message? What are the
Correct.
Slogans that
We're really anchored right now in the ceasefire first and foremost, but frankly, a ceasefire should have happened 1, 2, 3 weeks in at this point when you've destroyed a huge majority of the living situation in Gaza. Ceasefire now seems increasingly obsolete, although we want the atrocities to end. We want the violence and bombing to end. We also are asking Blinken to stop unconditional aid to Israel, to do a human rights audit on Israel, to exercise and look into the Leahy law and the application of violations of human rights and how countries are not supposed to be eligible to receive aid under our legal system if they commit atrocities and war crimes. None of that audit is happening, so that's also a pressure point for us. And then also acknowledging state-sponsored violence of Israel. We would like Blinken to acknowledge and the administration to acknowledge mass atrocities are being committed. Right now, we've only heard Blinken repeatedly say that my heart is with the people of Gaza, while simultaneously providing tons of weapons and bypassing Congress to provide additional weapons to Gaza. So we are tired of the hypocrisy. We want an acknowledgement of the violence that is being committed. We want an acknowledgement of the United States' role in that. Whether or not we're going to get it, we will continue to keep the pressure up until hopefully the relationship changes and enough Americans are awakened to call to take action. And I want to just add also, to date, we have given also 23,000 flyers out all around D.C. that talk about what is happening on the ground with links to resources and information, calls to action, and just kind of an overview of what's happening. We fly our cars. We attend, over the holidays, we attended Christmas markets and handed these out to strangers. We're trying to meet people where they are outside of the echo chambers of social media, which we know curates content based on what you're already interested in. And so that's why it's extremely important for us to meet people where they're at, to flyer, to advocate, to be in the streets. We have a lot of cars stop here and ask us questions. What is happening? Whose house is this? Why are you here? That is an opportunity to educate more people to realize that their tax dollars are being used to do this. No one's an innocent bystander if you are an American taxpayer, and everyone has a role to play. And we saw that type of pressure work during the Vietnam War, during segregation, during apartheid in South Africa, and that's the pressure we're trying to build.
Hazami Barmada, thank you so much for joining us from outside of Blinken's fortress there in the DC area. We would love to have you back on and follow these protests. Hopefully you won't have to be doing it much longer. Hopefully a just ceasefire and an end to this genocide and a lasting just resolution will happen soon. So thank you so much for all that you're doing and for being with us on the EI live stream.
Thank you so much. And please give our greetings and thanks to all of your comrades there. We really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Wow. Well, that was a mood lifter.
I mean, it's really, you know, I just have to say, when I saw some of those clips circulating, it just made me feel like, you know, I've taken part in protests before, and it is very empowering. I remember during the, back in 2009, after Operation, or 2010, it was a few months after Operation Cast Lead, so-called, one of the first big massacres, Ehud Olmert, the Israeli prime minister, came to the University of Chicago, and I took part with several dozen people in a protest and disruption. We got up one by one, and we made it impossible for him to speak. And it felt so empowering that they are confronted with their crimes. And I see people saying, you know, they're psychopaths, they don't care. And I think a lot of them probably are psychopaths. But I still think that confronting them with their crimes is important. It's what we can do. And I just found those videos to be so powerful. And other people see them. They circulate around the world. And it's so important that they are not insulated from the reality of their crimes.
That's right. Yeah, that there are consequences for their crimes and that they should not know peace. You know, when they are helping carry out a genocide. Ali, speaking of consequences, you wrote a couple of pieces very recently about the economic consequences that businesses who are either Israeli owned or do business with Israel are facing because of public revulsion around the world to Israel's genocide. Can you give us a sense of, you know, what's happening, for example, with, let's see, the Japanese corporation Itochu taking a decision to end its partnership with the Israeli weapons maker Elbit by the end of this month?
So we can start there. There's actually a lot to talk about, but let's start with Itochu. This is one of these Japanese firms that most of us have never heard of, but it is a conglomerate that is involved in everything from textiles to consumer goods to mining to aviation, and probably owns a lot of companies and brands we have heard of. So this is a huge company. And they announced just this week that they are ending an agreement with Elbit Systems, which is Israel's largest private weapons manufacturer, and which has made many of the weapons that Israel is using now in its genocide in Gaza. And Tsuyoshi Hachimura, the chief financial officer at Itochu, said that the partnership with Elbit was, quote, based on a request from Japan's defense ministry for the purpose of importing defense equipment for the self-defense forces of Japan, necessary for Japan's security, and is not in any way related to the current conflict between Israel and Palestine. In other words, their agreement pre-existed the genocide. It was actually an agreement signed in March of last year. And at the time it was signed, the Israeli ambassador hailed it as evidence of, quote, deepening relations between Israel and Japan, relations that are based on mutual interests and shared values, end quote. But the decision to end the relationship taken by Itochu clearly is related to the genocide in Gaza. And this is what Tsuyoshi Hachimura of the company said. He said, quote, taking into consideration the International Court of Justice's order on 26 January and that the Japanese government supports the role of the court, we have already suspended new activities related to the Memorandum of Understanding with Elbit and plan to end the Memorandum of Understanding by the end of February. So that's extremely significant.
It is. After the International Court of Justice's ruling, the significance of a major corporation not wanting to be implied, in the complicity with genocide. I mean, do you think that other corporations will follow suit? Sometimes it just takes one for a domino effect.
Well, it's already happening, and it's not just corporations, because the other announcement this week was that the government of Wallonia, which is one of Belgium's three federal regions, suspended arms export licenses to Israel, and it also explicitly cited the ICJ decision, which, as people will recall, ordered preventive measures based on its finding that Israel is plausibly accused of genocide. And I think that it's one thing for people to be critical of Israel, but when you have the world's highest court coming and saying, we think that there may well be genocide here, now all of a sudden people are saying, well, what are the legal consequences for me or for my company? And I don't want to be mixed up in genocide. Right. So there is also a history. I think there's a context here, which is that key rulings from the International Court of Justice in the case of Namibia, and this is going back now to the early and mid-1970s, and South Africa's apartheid, had that effect. Those rulings, even though, you know, as we've said, that the International Court of Justice by itself cannot enforce its rulings, they don't have a world police force that can go out, these rulings nonetheless have a significant impact because they place a legal responsibility on others. If you'll remember, Nora, when we spoke to legal experts Susan Akram and Michael Link about the ICJ ruling, they both predicted that these sorts of decisions would start to follow. Right. We also saw this week the foreign minister of Spain, actually just yesterday, told Al Jazeera that Spain has had frozen arms exports to Israel actually since October 7th. So we see governments starting to do this. Is it enough? Absolutely not. Oh, another victory is that announced by Palestine Action. That's the direct action group in the UK. And we've spoken to them on the Electronic Intifada live stream. They announced that they were notified by Kuhne and Nagel, which is a major Swiss-based international shipping and logistics company, that it had also ended its contract with Elbit Systems and will not be working with the Israeli weapons maker again. And this followed a number of actions by Palestine Action activists at various Kuhne and Nagel offices and properties around the UK, which involved smashing windows, spray painting the inside, breaking into their offices. That's from Palestine Action's press release. And as we know, Palestine Action has been doing these sorts of activities for years, targeting Elbit Systems, and repeatedly its activists have been criminally prosecuted by authorities in the UK for damaging property and breaking and entering and so on, and have been acquitted because they've successfully argued in court that their actions are to prevent a greater crime of genocide. And so this shows, relating back to our conversation with Hazami, that this kind of direct action, you know, of course, people are making decisions about staying on, you know, which side of the law they're on. And Palestine Action has shown that they are on the right side of the law with these actions, as the acquittals have shown, that they actually do have an impact. So we're seeing governments now, corporations taking these actions. But let's remember that it is at the grassroots that these things start. It is with protest, yeah, with solidarity, with boycotts and direct action. And we'll get to that, to more of that in a second. But go on, Asa. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I just wanted to make the point about this Japanese conglomerate, which I also had not heard of, but it is this massively important global conglomerate. It's, you know, I read it's in the Fortune 500. Itochu. There's two points to me about the significance of this. Is first of all, as you mentioned, the impact of the ICJ ruling. Like, we see that already, and you know, we mentioned when we've had these discussions before about the impact of the ICJ ruling that Israel is plausibly, that South Africa has a plausible case that Israel is carrying out a genocide in the Gaza Strip, and that Israel must stop those actions. There were people, you know, understandably, who got frustrated with the ICJ that it didn't explicitly use the word ceasefire. Although, I mean, really, the implication of the only, as the South Africans said afterwards, the only way the ruling could be implemented is through a ceasefire. But we're starting to see the material benefits of that ruling, you know, already in these examples you've laid out there and in your new article. I think it's really important. And this is, I mean, we've all been reporting, all three of us have been reporting on the BDS movement for many, many years. And, you know, especially since the Palestinian call for BDS in 2005. And I mean, I don't know about you two, but I can't remember a time ever, I mean, there may be one that I can't recall, but I can't remember a time ever when there's been a BDS. I mean, there's so many BDS victories we've reported on over the years, but I can't remember a single time when one of these corporations explicitly said, yeah, this is about Israel. This is about these issues. This is a result of what is happening to the Palestinians. And they're not even, you know, even this, they're not necessarily doing it in a particularly moral way, but they are explicitly confirming it is because of this, and that protest does make a difference. Because normally they try and get out of it and say, well, it had nothing to do. Sometimes they've explicitly said the opposite. Oh, it had nothing to do with the protesters.
It was just a contract issue.
Even when we know it did. Yeah. Right. Even when we right. know it
even
did.
Though we know that it, in reality, it did. But I can't remember this ever happening before where they've explicitly said, yeah, this is because of, you know, we support the Japanese government supports the work of the ICJ, of the World Court.
Yeah.
That's such a good point, Asa. I mean, you know, boycott, divestment and sanctions, or BDS activists, have always said, you know, it's nice when companies acknowledge that they're leaving Israel or boycotting Israel or ending business in Israel. And there have been big companies that have done that as a result of campaigns, conglomerates like Veolia, Orange, the big mobile communications firm, and others that have left Israel over the years, precisely because of activism. But as you've said, Asa, they don't say it's because of that activism. And the response of BDS organizers has always been, well, it doesn't really matter as long as they leave. We know why they left. They know why they left. But I do agree, it takes it to another level when you have companies like this saying, yeah, it's because of the ICJ decision. And so it may well be that we're entering a phase, a new phase, where things will accelerate. And I certainly hope so in terms of this kind of action.
Ali, you also wrote about a kind of a ad hoc consumer boycott against McDonald's, and how the, you know, a major, you know, I think it was the CEO that had to admit that its profits were being dented.
Right. Yeah. So this is a really interesting story because McDonald's Corporation, and we all know who McDonald's is, they held their quarterly sales call, or their quarterly call with investors earlier this week. And they acknowledged that they have suffered a significant loss of sales in the Middle East since the start of the genocide in Gaza, and not just in the Middle East. They were quite explicit in saying that it's much broader than that, and it's particularly in places where there are large Muslim consumer markets, including, and they cited specifically, Malaysia and Indonesia. Indonesia, of course, is the world's most populous Muslim majority country. But they also say, and this is, I'm quoting Chris Kempczinski, the CEO of McDonald's. He says, in a country, for example, like France, that has a larger Muslim population, we are seeing some impact. And he noted that in France, the drop in sales, quotes, depends very much on where the restaurant is located and if it's in a Muslim area. And that's very significant because it shows really the power of Muslim communities, not just in their own countries, but also in Europe and North America. And it's maybe a topic for another day, but in the United States now, we see Muslim organizations and communities organizing against Biden to deny him the vote in the you know, in the upcoming U.S. elections. But this shows that it has a real impact. And while McDonald's wouldn't say, they wouldn't put a dollar figure on it, they were very explicit that it is a significant impact on their profits across the region, and they said that they didn't expect things to get better until the war ends.
Right.
And yeah.
Sorry, and I just want to point out the reason why people have been boycotting McDonald's. Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is on a number of levels. That, let's say, there's McDonald's specific issues, and then I think there's a broader response. The McDonald's specific issues is, as many people may know, McDonald's business model is franchising. The vast majority of McDonald's restaurants you see are not owned and operated by McDonald's Corporation. They're owned and operated by franchisees who have to invest a lot of their own money to buy and set up these restaurants. And then they share the profits with McDonald's. They pay royalties to McDonald's. And so that's how the company makes most of its money. So in Israel, the McDonald's Israel franchise, after October 7th, announced that they were giving away thousands of free meals to the Israeli soldiers taking part in the genocide in Gaza. And this produced a huge backlash across the region, in Arab countries and in Turkey in particular. And some of the McDonald's franchises in those countries tried to counter it by distancing themselves from what McDonald's Israel had done. And some of them even announced that they were giving sums of money in support of humanitarian aid for Palestinians in Gaza. But it didn't work because people, you hear this argument. I'll say more about this, but I just came back a couple of days ago from Jordan. And the argument you hear sometimes from business people is, well, you know, yes, it's McDonald's, but it's locally owned and operated, and the employees are local people, so we shouldn't punish them. But people didn't buy that, and McDonald's had to admit that it has suffered a significant business impact. Again, not just in the Middle East, not just in Malaysia and Indonesia, but in other countries where there are significant Muslim populations showing their consumer power. And the other company that's been affected, that admitted it's been affected, is Starbucks. Again, another iconic brand name. And they had to admit that they've taken a hit. They claim to be, you know, neutral. They say we have no political agenda. But in fact, what happened a few weeks ago was that the Starbucks Workers Union put out a tweet in support of Palestinian rights, and the Starbucks Corporation repudiated it and actually sued the union for infringing on its trademark, because they said the union's logo and name are too similar to Starbucks and people will confuse that their position with Starbucks. But in fact, Starbucks was pandering to right-wing anti-Palestinian media and politicians in the United States who objected to the tweet by the Starbucks Workers Union. So far from being neutral, Starbucks was actually rejecting support for Palestinian rights and trying to appease the right wing. What it actually did was it enraged everyone. And as a result of boycotts by supporters of Palestinian rights and by opponents of Palestinian rights, it saw a measurable drop in its business and revenues. But I think there's a bigger picture here. So you can point at those specifics related to McDonald's and Starbucks. But I think what's mostly driving this is a general revulsion at the role of the United States and the West. And this kind of consumer boycott is one of the few direct ways people have of making decisions which they see as supporting Palestinian rights and punishing the countries or governments or corporations they see as responsible. So when I was in Jordan, and I just came back a few days ago to the United States, it's very apparent that boycotting McDonald's, and not just McDonald's, but pretty much every major American brand and some European brands like Carrefour, the supermarket chain, and Nescafe, is now a cultural norm. To the extent that, you know, Coca-Cola and Pepsi, which were extremely popular in Jordan, you don't see them at restaurants anymore. People are now serving local alternatives or other brands which are not in the public mind associated with the United States. And that's become the norm. If you were to walk around with a Coca-Cola, people would be upset at you. And you'll hear people saying, oh, yeah, you know, that you drive past McDonald's and it's empty, and that's very satisfying to them. So I think this is part of a bigger phenomenon that is not necessarily about the specifics of those countries, but just a general rejection of these brands and saying, you know, we want to make known to the United States that there is a price, there are consequences for your role in this genocide.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much, Ali, for giving us those reports. And of course, we're going to continue to follow the consumer boycotts and the divestment, maneuvers by major corporations, and of course sanctions. I mean, this is it's quite a time for people to be able to move the boycott movement like they've been doing recently. Incredible. Okay, so we're gonna turn to John now for his analysis of the Palestinian resistance and their maneuvers, and then we're gonna have a discussion afterwards about the possible ceasefire and any news related to political negotiations. Hello, John. What's been happening on the ground in Gaza while all of this has been going on?
Hey guys, yeah. Well, we're moving forward on the ceasefire talks, but the war on the Palestinian civilian population has continued unabated. We're seeing the same level of airstrikes and targeting of civilians that hasn't tapered off at all. The Israelis are not, the Israeli troops are not as deep into territory as they have been in recent weeks. But the airstrikes are continuing and killing 150 people a day, still targeting hospitals, still dismantling the civic infrastructure of the Gaza Strip, while showing very few significant military gains to justify this brutal genocide that we've been watching now entering its fifth month. So Maureen reported, and you reported, Nora, earlier on in the show about some of the satellite imagery that's come out from the Gaza Strip that we're going to show you here. To give just give people a sense of what it looks like when we're talking about 35,000 airstrikes, you know, hundreds of thousands of tank shells targeting the civilian infrastructure in the Gaza Strip as a response to the October 7th military assault, which collapsed the Gaza division and cast the Israeli security establishment into disrepute within the society in Israel. And so what we're seeing is the Israeli military taking it out on the civilian population in the Gaza Strip as an attempt.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganyagaha language and Muniang in Anishinaabe Mohan, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end in English and in French. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, live in studio on Thursday, February the 8th, 2024. What a mild evening out this weekend. You definitely don't need to batten down the hatches this weekend because the temperatures are really just right to warm up in the theater and check out local art. We have lots of things ahead for you this coming hour. We will mark big anniversaries in the dance world. Dance-iversaries, if you will. The legendary Margie Gillis is in town for her company's performance of Littérature du Corps. She is marking 50 years in the business and she'll be our first guest this evening. Before the end of the hour, Claude Caron is the artistic director and choreographer of Ballet West de Montréal. The company is marking 40 years of dance and education this week. We'll find out about